Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Government vs. the Robots, the fortnightly podcast that takes a look at how technology will influence politics in the future. This is the final episode of Series 2 of Government vs. the Robots. I don't want to spoil what's to come for you, but there is a plea at the end to get in touch with us if you want to influence Series 3. We've got some time to do some thinking about the issues we tackle in the future, and now would be a great time to hear from people who've been following these discussions and want to have their say about where we go next. As for who the guest is this week, that's me, and I'm being interviewed by Liz Carolan, who you might remember from the episode Lessons from Ireland. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to Government versus the Robots. I am your guest host for 1 week only, Liz Carolan, and I'm here with Jonathan, and we're going to be picking his brain now that two seasons of the podcast are coming to a close. This is, we believe, episode number 41. So very, very happy to be here, Jonathan.
It's very strange to be here. We've just swapped chairs.
We have.
And I've sat in that chair for the last 40 episodes, and being on this side of the desk is a bit strange. And I'm actually, I confess to being quite nervous, because I'm conscious a lot of the people who we've had on the show have written books, they're experienced speakers, and all I've done really is ask people a lot of questions. So as to how much wisdom I'll be able to share in this interview, I don't know, but let's find out.
Well, I'm personally very excited as a listener to the podcast. You know, I've just even looking back at the sheer amount of people and the variety of people that you've spoken with over the last sort of nearly 2 years. So should we dive right in, and maybe you could explain how this came about? What's the kind of the story that led us to sitting here today?
Yeah, I guess there's different bits to that. I mean, the main thing is, if I'm honest about it, I spent most of the last decade working in international development, and that has been really interesting and been great for kind of getting a perspective on the world, I guess. But as things started to shift in British politics, when I first left university, I went to work in Parliament, and I was kind of thinking, oh, politics would be the thing that I do, and then I jumped into international development. And in 2016, a lot of stuff happened that everybody's very familiar with that started to feel like things had really changed somehow. And working in development, I felt like there was something I wanted to keep my eye in on politics and understand something. So there was a bit of kind of, I managed to negotiate in my job to do a 4 day week so that I had 1 day a week to devote towards thinking about the podcast, which was great. And having a supportive boss in doing that was a fantastic thing. But I guess a more personal answer is, having worked in think tanks and sort of smart organisations, so I worked for the Overseas Development Institute and then went to work for the Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative, which was full of kind of Oxbridge graduate McKinsey types, the same as at ODI. And having not been to Oxbridge and not having a kind of wealth of experience in that way, I've often felt like I don't think as hard about stuff as like proper policy people. So as a communications person, you kind of often get told, or you put the gloss on this, or you can put the spin on this. And then you watch policy people sort of sit, and I think actually probably imagine them sat in a library for kind of 3 days on end, just thinking hard. And for me, doing the podcast was about trying to think really hard about something that felt like it was quite fundamental, that was changing in the world around me, but doing that in a discursive way, because I've always really enjoyed working with smart people, because you can ask them questions, and one of the things that I've tended to be okay at is articulating their ideas, sometimes better than them. I'm sure they would be happy to admit, And I really enjoy asking people questions. And I think wherever I go with the future of the podcast, which is something that we might talk about in a bit, the thing that I've loved is being able to interview people and sort of understand not just their knowledge, but a bit about them as well. So that's where it all came from.
And so what have you learned now that you're 40 or so interviews in?
Oof, a few things. I mean, there's things I've learned about the process of podcast making, which I won't talk about at the moment. But in terms of kind of how society's changing, or what do I think about it? If I think back to the very first episode of Government versus Robots, where we had Isabel Dedring, who had worked for the Mayor of London on transport, and we talked about driverless cars. And I very much came at that from the point of view of what I wanted to do was look at each technology and explore how that technology was going to impact political conversations in the future. And I think one of the big things I've learned is that, and bear with me because I need to try and explain this, it isn't the technology that is the driving force of all of this. Like, tech is changing our world hugely, but the technologies themselves are not the issue. And I think some people have said that, but I don't think I've thought about it. There's a danger of going down a kind of technological determinism route with this, where, oh, it's all about the tech, it's all about the social media companies. And it is to some degree, but it's also about age-old things like economics. You know, you wouldn't have the political situation we have right now if it wasn't for the economic situation we have right now. And you can discuss whether that's about equality or opportunity or, you know, globalization or whatever it might be. But economics is a huge part of this. You know, equally, when it comes to the big social media companies, you know, that's about power. Mm-hmm. And it's increasingly for them, it's about the amount of power that they monopolize. And when we think about them as monopolies, they're as much monopolies on power as they are monopolies on wealth in any real sense. And so one thing for me is, like, the actual tech doesn't matter as much, which isn't to say that there aren't going to be lots of moments in the future where things we've discussed on this podcast happen, like Alexa being involved in court cases, or, you know, people being killed by driverless cars, which has already happened in the States, but happened in a much more visceral way. And I think people who are thinking about communications on these issues should be ready for that. Other things, I think there's kind of three trends that I would box things into. So the first is around fragmentation. I think it's pretty much received wisdom now that we've seen a fragmentation in media and the way people consume media. And that fragmentation has led to a rise in identity politics because people have different perceptions. And I think being at South by Southwest and recording the episodes I recorded from South by Southwest earlier in the year, listening to big media companies and big marketing organizations with, like, multi-million pound budgets, all talking about the need to personalize more and this kind of hyper-personalization, I think we're only going to see things get more personalized. And I think that's probably going to mean we're only going to see politics get more identity driven. And I don't think that's a good thing, because if, as seems to be the case, people want kind of unimpeachable characters to be their political standard bearers, unimpeachable characters don't exist. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to write someone off on the basis of one thing they think, there might be 99, not that everybody thinks 100 things, but there might be 99 things that they think that are really valuable. And the fragmentation problem is preventing that. And I think it's also meaning that you need really strong, powerful ideas to cut across fragmented media consumption. Second one is around trust and reality. What reality is slowly shifting, and a virtual reality will change that, but our perceptions of what is real are different. And that isn't just about deep fake videos and whether it's a fake Nancy Pelosi video or whatever it might be. It's also about kind of what you understand to be the reality of the world. So if you take the kind of classic people who think along conspiracy theory lines, you know, they see reality as something different to the mainstream. That kind of thinking, I think, is creeping in more and more, in that people have their own view of what the world really is. And because of disinformation efforts and because of the kind of dilution of legitimacy in media, that concept of different realities is changing, and the ability of external actors to shape what reality is received as by people is changing. And I think there's a practical implication of that in terms of, like, how important symbols are, for example. So I think one of the reasons Extinction Rebellion's been really successful in the last year or so is because their symbols are really powerful, and symbols can mean a million things to a million people. And in a really fragmented, identity-driven political space, that's a really powerful thing to be able to wield. And then the third last thing that has been discussed loads on the podcast is the importance of looking at, like, tech monopolies, but not just from the point of view of they own the market, but you know, the monopoly they now have over the future shape of society in terms of how we deliver digital public services, whether that's digital doctors or, you know, schools that are using Facebook modules, whatever it might be, whether it's, you know, which algorithms are used to make decisions over who gets life insurance, what's your life insurance premium, all of that has got tech companies at the heart of it. And I just don't think it's a case of, well, we need to regulate these people so that they can't wield as much power. It's going to be much more complex than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we could probably unpack that for about 3 days, everything you've said there. But I think that question of power is one which I feel like, looking back at the back catalogue, the first podcast you did was about driverless cars. And I think the next few, I have them here, so those was MedTech, Online People Power. It was quite positive, and this was like, sorry, around the end, towards the end of 2017. Mm. And then actually looking back at the last few, I know your most recent interview, you know, the interviewee said he was sort of an optimist. But I think the two before that were about lies and disinfo, and you know, Nanjala's great work on, you know, what's happening in an African context. And so do you feel yourself that you've become less optimistic over that period of time, or like, where do you sit in the optimism pessimism sort of spectrum at the moment?
Definitely like towards the middle, and that isn't because that's like my ideological lodestar, but I've said a lot on the podcast, you can go dystopian with the future on this, or you can go utopian, and neither is the reality, because the present is always a bit shit and a bit good, like in mm-hmm. different ways, and you can always find something that's good about the present, you always find something a bit shit about it, and that will always be the case. I think even, you know, in most societies that are run in less democratic ways than ours, I suspect most people, if you ask them what's good in your life and what's bad in your life right now, would be able to point to very tangible examples of both. And so dystopia, utopia doesn't work. Where am I? Oh man, I mean, I'm probably not that far off the kind of, there's an episode called Can Things Get Even Worse, which was the first Jamie Bartlett episode that we did. And he was like, I'm really pessimistic about this, like relentlessly pessimistic. I don't know. Like, I feel like if we don't get our shit together, then things are going to be really bad. But I see people starting to get their shit together. Like, I think as a set of people in a community thinking about the kind of questions we've discussed on this podcast, quite a good job has been done now, although there's probably a bit of the comms guy in me wants to do it a bit further, of kind of problem definition. I think we know what a lot of the issues that are in play are, whether that is about state-to-state disinformation, whether it's about a lack of transparency around data, people's data. You know, we know where all these issues are, but we don't really know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And for me, coming from a kind of political space, at its core on that is we haven't worked out, if you consider yourself to be progressive, which is a term that like I hate in so many respects, we haven't quite worked out how to respond to the really successful model that's been applied by definitely the right, and I wonder which word to put in front of the right at different times. And I think for me, I don't know how positive or pessimistic to be yet, because I don't think the best response has been tried. So if you look at kind of messaging on Facebook, and you see loads of stuff about how content that gets put on Facebook is incentivized to be radical and bring emotion out of people and stuff, which is all true. If you put a junk bit of content into Facebook, if you're like a comms person for a charity or something, you might expect the algorithm to give you a kind of like 0.7% return on what you've done. If you put a really good, smart bit of content into Facebook, you know, you've thought about, like, you've used a meme or something, and your chief exec's posted a cartoon, and that's a different thing on Twitter, then people react to it differently. The algorithm might give you like a 1.2% return on what you've put in. If you back that up with data, you can get up to 1.5. And if you back it up with outrage and visceral human emotion, like fear, then you might get like 2.5. Mm-hmm. And the return on the algorithm, I don't think we've yet put, as progressives, the best type of content we can put into the communications ecosystem to try and take on the right. Mm. And when I say the right, I don't mean the center right, because I don't necessarily want to take them on. I often would rather look to try and find common ground and not make it a battle, because everything's set up to be a battle these days. but the right that is in the ascendancy across Europe and America and other parts of the world, to take them on, I don't know that we've played them at their own game yet. And I don't think I can really know whether to be optimistic or pessimistic till we do.
Do you? So you mentioned there sort of we have a bit of a sense of what the problem is and we're trying to figure out what to do with it. And I think, you know, your last point there, you know, if the problem is, you know, whole scale manipulation of the information environment by extremists, and this is being enabled by the architecture, right, by algorithms or, you know, whatever it is, you know, is the response to that to play people at their own game, or is the response to try and restructure this kind of architecture piece?
I'm going to say the $64,000 question. Yeah. I have no idea where that phrase came from. I think it was like a US game show or something.
Feels like
it was
a game show.
I think it was
thing,
on like
it?
Before I was even born.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say it's the $64,000 question, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. The answer is probably it's going to be a bit of both. Instinctively, I look at it at the moment and I feel like people who, having watched The Great Hack in the last week or so, which people who think that we can just regulate our way out of this situation are barking up the wrong tree, partly because we're not going to be in a position to do any regulating anytime soon because the politics are so fucked. And so for me, you might be able to make some wins if you take on an ideologically driven government that is being talked to every day by lobbyists owned by the biggest companies in the world, which are Facebook, Google, and so on. Then you might be able to win some concessions, but we're not going to be able to get to a scenario where the real stuff that we need to stop from happening isn't happening. So for me, I'll regulate it and it'll go away, which is a slightly unfair caricature, is definitely the wrong way to look at it. I am instinctively more interested in how do we play by these new rules. One of the things with the Cambridge Analytica story, and to be clear, what happened, you know, they nicked a load of data, didn't tell people they had it, and used it to influence an election as best they possibly could. And the result of that election in terms of the referendum in the UK was very tight. Doesn't lead me to say the reason that the referendum went with Brexit was because of Cambridge Analytica, because there's lots of other reasons, like I said at the start, around economics, around power, around what's the vision for the future and how's the currency of hope in Britain at any given moment. So I would draw back from saying that it affected the referendum. But all of the tools that Cambridge Analytica used are in theory out there to be gained ethically and to be used ethically. Now, you might not be able to build exactly the same model, but I do think, I don't feel confident that we've yet managed to put out really good, data-informed, progressive messaging that plays to the environment as it is at the moment and seeing what we get in return. So, I annoyingly, it's the exact context has escaped me last night, but I saw some research by a guy who's really good at Twitter mapping. He was saying that he's kind of concluded that basically, the really sharp messaging of the right is meeting a receptive audience, and that's what's happening. And as a communications person, I can't help but think, actually, I don't think we've done everything we can to fight back yet. And so, yes, regulation is important, but I'd come down more on the, okay, if the world's changed, how are we going to do things differently? And I've got some thoughts about that, but definitely don't have a kind of like finished model.
It's funny, I'm probably a little bit inclined to disagree. I think, and again, this is just some of the content that's kind of come through your interviewees. Like, there's something, you know, and this is something like manipulation of the information sphere, you know, rather than it being so, I think, necessarily tied into a sort of left or right ideology. I think there's, you know, trying to get people who are in it for the right goals to agree with each other on something within the team is incredibly difficult. So, you know, think like, you know, can you get that group of people to agree to a very base sort of campaign, or, you know, or to something which is so data driven that it sort of has to suppress values, I think would be incredibly different. I think there's also, you know, and I see this in work around sort of elections and election responses. There's also a bit of like, you know, in a scenario where you have progressives getting into power through similar data manipulation or something else, they are there because of that. And then how on earth are we going to sort of fix the structural problems? There's something that you're kind of nearly baking in.
I don't think we're yet in a place where we can say that to run a kind of fairly base campaign, you have to suppress values. I don't think we're there yet. That might be the case. Well, I don't think that hypothesis has been tested enough.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And until it has been, I don't think it's possible to conclude what you might do. So if you look at like political comms, for example, at the moment, most of my work at the moment is with More United, which I'm kind of happy to talk about. We can not talk about it, whether it's relevant or not. But I'm obviously thinking about how, as a movement, do you get the More United message out there? And something that strikes me is that for a lot of political organisations, using volunteers has been about like physical time out in communities, like knocking on doors, having conversations. Really important. You talked about how important that was in the Irish referendum. And it is important, but equally, if you can get people to commit time online, that's really important too. And so who's thinking about like what does proper, effective online organising look like, where, you know, there are columnists in the UK whose columns get shared really widely on Twitter and Facebook, the first comment in the comments, who's it from? You know, and often you see stuff where it's kind of possibly been written by a bot. You see stuff where it might have been driven there by somebody from the Brexit party. Like, what's the response to that? Equally, phone-ins. Like, who's thinking about the fact that there are phone-ins that hundreds of thousands of people across the country are listening to? Now, you can debate the ethics of it, but a coordinated outreach to those phone-ins on a regular basis, from a progressive point of view, would be a really helpful contribution to the political environment right now. But I don't know that there's a political entity that's really in a position to encourage that on a regular basis. So there are things that in this environment you can still do that are fairly simple, that if you've got people who are willing to commit time to work with you, you can try and get somewhere.
And I guess this goes a bit to your initial point of, you know, the technology is all well and good, but actually some of these issues that we're seeing, some of these challenges, you know, say around campaigning for progressive issues, are perhaps the digital manifestation of that is sort of, you know, perhaps just reflecting some of the broader challenges that are people-centred.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a while, I think, for things to trickle through. So I look at what the Brexit party are doing with their comms, and so much of it is so smart. Like, they've got, I think it's called Brexit Box or something similar to that, which is their, like, TV channel, where they're just broadcasting straight out. You know, and everyone gets, you know, it's received wisdom that people who are chief execs of big campaigning organisations, they know that you can do unmediated comms and that your own channels are really important. But I don't think they've like realised yet that you can make your own TV.
Yeah.
And if you do it well, that's a strong contribution to the debate around your issue. And it just feels to me there's a bit of lag. You know, in the development world, people want to be in DevEx or in The Guardian. And who's thinking about like joe.co.uk or like joe.ie, where it started? It feels to me like there's a bit of lag between the kind of received wisdom of how, if you've got an issue, how you make sure that issue is prominent and being discussed. And then there's the question around framing, which is where the volatility of language comes in. So people have been discussing this week. There's a video, it's like, watch Jeremy Corbyn get schooled by Boris Johnson at PMQs, and people have picked up on the schooled language, and Boris has, you know, just kind of like bombastically shredded Corbyn at PMQs, which is yet another example of how PMQs is now all just about getting your clip so that you put out on your social channel, which then, you know, that's from an organisational point of view, what does that mean for your media strategy and how you approach media? It probably isn't about getting a nice article written up. It might be about getting an interview where, as long as you say your message and you get your 30-second clip out and it's on a trusted platform, although some people would argue that stuff that comes from less trusted platforms is ironically more trusted, then you've done the job. So there's definitely a change in political and issue driven communication strategy I don't feel has been explored enough.
Yeah, fascinating. And so what should we be watching then for upcoming elections? We may have one here in the UK shortly.
We'll definitely have one in the US next year as well. And I think, you know, if you are kind of want to learn as much as you can about how to try and operate I do hate the word progressive, like, because it just means so much. But just quickly on that, like, if you're someone who thinks the world should be changed for the better and you're in the business of how to do that rather than someone who instinctively feels like the world's kind of okay as it is, thanks. If you're someone who wants to change the world for the better, have a look at, even now, all the Democratic candidates in the States. How are they doing their comms? How are they doing their organising? Try and get on their mailing lists. See what their messaging's like. Are they hiring people who are better at making memes than they are writing blogs, for example? So thinking about that, but I mean, more broadly, next election, it's going to be, you're going to see a lot of stuff that Benedict Pringle talked about in the episode around political advertising, which is where you get unaffiliated accounts on social doing stuff. So just quickly, if you look at Love Island's finish this week, on Love Island, on Twitter, you get a lot of unofficial Love Island accounts. Now, I have it on good authority that those unofficial Love Island accounts aren't always so unofficial.
Shocking.
And that those are being made because they enable people to have kind of plausible deniability of content, but they want that type of messaging out there and they know it's going to work better. Now, in a really kind of like almost comically bad example, if you look at something like Avid for Javid, which Sajid Javid had as his Tory leadership campaign, he had an Avid for Javid account. There was a Girls for Gove. There's a Maze Gaze fan club account. That environment on social of kind of having communities of support that aren't affiliated in any public way with a campaign, I think that's going to grow and grow and grow. And you saw in Jeremy Corbyn's team's response to the anti-Semitism Panorama show, somebody leaked the lines for Outriders, I think it was called. And those Outriders are people on social media who are very happy to put out the message that needs to go out from Labour HQ, but they're not Labour affiliated accounts. And they also want people to create content, so create meme style content within certain parameters. And I think having, you'll see a lot more of that kind of hidden war of messaging. So there'll be a lot of stuff that seems to be popping up from people who've just made memes and so on, which is all being kind of orchestrated, is probably too strong a word, because if you think about the principles of new power, which is probably my favorite episode of the podcast, you do have to let movements do their own thing. So conducted is probably a better word than orchestrated by the different campaigns. So I think we'll see a lot of that on social. I think we'll see a lot of like the media just being used, like totally used as a vessel for people to position themselves how they want and shout how they want. And a classic example of that is when Nigel Farage went on the Mar show a little while ago, and it got written up as Farage loses his cool on the BBC. And he was ranting about how the BBC is a failed organisation and no one should listen to what it says anymore, and this is why nobody trusts it. And of course, the only clip that on all of his channels was shared was just him saying the BBC is a failed institution, nobody trusts it anymore, but with the legitimacy of the BBC platform. So the idea that that wasn't premeditated to me is nonsense. Like, he didn't lose it. He knew exactly what he was doing. And I think you'll see a lot more, particularly on TV, people just going on to say exactly what they went on to say and not care about the rest of it. And in that environment, that's easier to do, because you could argue that's always been the way. Like, that was what message discipline was about in 1997. But it is different because it's about the clip and it's about how you share the clip to your own audience. Whereas in 97, it was much harder to clip stuff. And so equally, at the same time, I think I'd also be watching for the potential of closed Facebook groups and WhatsApp groups. So I know in India, WhatsApp played a big role in the last elections. You're probably even more familiar with it than me, Liz. But I think I know several people who've been added to neighbourhood WhatsApp groups recently, which feel like the kind of spaces that shit can spread really fast. That's kind of like the new Facebook wall. So who's thinking about that space and how that's contested around an election? And then I think you'll see a lot of moments which are manufactured just to create emotion. So I'm trying to think of an example of that, but I think there's going to be a lot of situations where something that is about your emotional response becomes the main story of the day, which couldn't be further removed from policy. So if you take... all the examples are really controversial, right? So if I think about two to do with Boris, there are always areas of grey in politics on perception. So if you look at Boris's argument with his girlfriend and how everyone kicked off about that, right? None of us had full possession of the facts. Like, literally none of us know exactly what was going on there. Like, whether it's off the scale Boris losing his temper or whether it was just a bit of a tiff, like, who knows? But that everyone in the country had their view, and that view seems to come down on the side of what is your pre-existing political position. And where it seems more and more, where there's a place that you can have a split of opinion, people's like ethical, moral, political judgment on something is totally aligned with their political position. It's like somehow the two are, ethics and politics are the same all of a sudden, because your identity is so in hoc to needing to agree with these people and your kind of tribe all of the time. And so from an electoral point of view, I think that plays to the interests of people who don't want to be having proper policy orientated discussions. So I imagine you'll see a few like outlandish statements that are made purely to distract. Like, it's funny how someone like Trump, people say, oh, he's really strategic at like throwing up kind of distracting balloons. Is he strategic or is he just a reactionary idiot? The two kind of get conflated. It doesn't matter. The reality is we're in a situation now where Donald Trump tweets something and that's still now the news story for 36 hours. And that prevents anything else coming through that is a bit more kind of normal and less about emotion and less about ethics and position. And because things are so polarized and everyone's either side of the fence, that stuff serves him because his side of the fence is currently stronger for reasons we've already discussed. And I think you'll see that here in the UK. Like, I think you will see people make statements that are preconceived to be uncomfortable. Like, if you think about Boris's article on the burqa, for example, like that was preconceived. I think we'll see some equivalence of that in elections in the UK.
Oh, interesting. Well, and when you put that together with your earlier point about personalization and sort of the increasing sort of bubbleization, is that the word? Like, and sort of your discussions of sort of power, right? And, you know, even like I think a lot of the tactics that you're talking about there of, you know, your Love Island-esque sort of artificial creation of the information environments. When you combine all of those things together, it's probably little wonder that, you know, if people are in a sort of closed information environment, you know, that starts to translate into the political environment, you know, ethics. All of these things become so sort of intertwined and oppositional, right?
Yeah.
To something different, yeah.
It's kind of the little things that add up to make the particular political culture of a moment.
Mm.
And that's why I think you kind of got to break them all down and try and address them all in different ways. And I don't necessarily know how to address them all. And thankfully, people are starting to think about it. You know, there's lots of projects about polarization, how to bring people together. You know, you're working on integrity of democracy. There's a lot of stuff starting to happen now. But I still feel like it would be nice to kind of... I haven't yet seen, here are the six areas that are adding up to the political culture that we now have, and here is how we have to tackle each of them.
Mm.
It doesn't feel like that kind of manifesto of action is out there yet.
Yeah.
I might spend some time trying to write about that over the next few weeks while the podcast's on a break, but we'll see.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What's the thing that gives you the most optimism? Like,
lots of the guests, like just generally, and as I say, like you know, there's a lot of hard thought going into this. There's a lot of good people thinking about it and scratching their heads and taking the initiative to try and start doing stuff that doesn't already exist to react to the new environment in which we find ourselves. I mean, I think a few different strands that feel to me important. Alex Evans was on recently on an episode called Trigger Warning, talking about collective psychology, but he made a really important point about there being a kind of larger us. So us operating in a lot of an us versus them mentality, which is very much about the tribalism and about identity, and that the best big breakthrough moments in social progress have been driven by a narrative that is about a larger us and what brings us together and binds us. You know, at the moment we're missing the kind of myths, is how he would put it, that enable us to see beyond our tribes and think about us as one. And climate's a really obvious area for doing that. That, I think, is a really important route. That said, with a touch of skepticism about whether it works in the current environment or how you adapt it for the current environment, because it's almost like you need a them. Like, you kind of need a them. And so, but who is that them sort of needs to be external to humanity, which is, if you go back from a common storytelling point of view, that's where like the idea of the devil and all that stuff came from. Because if we want to bring people together as a planet to tackle something like climate change, our them really needs to not be one of us, because you're doing the oppositionalism thing. So I think thinking around how you create a larger us and how you create narratives that can bring the largest number of people together is really important, and it seems to be happening. People are getting much more aware of data rights. And I think that whole conversation's got a long way to go in terms of how do we use our data for good. You know, at the moment, it's often seen as it's bad that we give our data away. Like, it doesn't have to be bad that we give our data away. As long as we know who we're giving our data and what they're doing with it, that can be fantastic. It can be fantastic for research purposes. It can be fantastic for social movements. And it can be fantastic for delivering public services. So the data rights conversation, I think, although often is received as being, we're a bit on the back foot because of stuff that's happened, I think that there's a lot of promise in where we can go with that. I think there's in some quarters, maybe this is just kind of like a bit for me, there's a lot more thinking around like empathy and humanity in an institutional sense. So Nadine Smith was on an episode called 21st Century Government, and from the Institute for Government, and they've done a lot of thinking about institutional legitimacy and what does smart government look like in the 21st century, and humanity and empathy are important parts of that. And I think the more we as a society, I guess, can try and keep that at the root of how we behave, both individually and as institutions and corporations and whatever it might be, the better. So that's some active thinking. And then what's missing that would make me more positive, I don't think there's a really good understanding of what an active citizen does right now. And I'm complicit in this. I've sat in loads of conversations, including like 40 in this room, about what do we do about this terrible state of affairs. How much like practical stuff out there being an active citizen have I done at the same time? Like, a charitable interpretation is making the podcast as active citizenship. A less charitable interpretation is like, how much time have you given away for free to something? Because of the state of the Labour Party particularly, I don't think there's a really obvious receptacle for active citizenship or a kind of manifesto for what an active citizen does in this world. I think that's missing, and I think we need it, and I'd like to see more of an understanding of it. And then lastly, I've got to plug More United at this point, just because working with More United, which is now the UK's largest cross-party movement, we've got 150,000 supporters and 60 MPs in what is the kind of first ever permanent network of MPs who are going to regularly work cross-party in Parliament, no matter which government is in power, to try and make progress on issues that they can find agreement on. It feels very important in such a polarised space that genuinely something new is emerging that people and politicians are buying into, that says that we want to live in a more united country. We've got shared agreement about what that is. It's like a country where everybody has an equal say, country where everybody gets the chance to make the most of their talents, country that looks after the environment for future generations. And we're going to campaign for it and try and make it happen. And with so much uncertainty in the political environment at the moment, we just don't know where things are going to go, right? You've got the Lib Dems are very much enjoying a resurgence. Labour perceptions on that vary. My own are deeply bleak. But with More United, there's an opportunity for people around the UK, no matter who their MP is, to engage with a movement that is able to support MPs who are trying to come together and put country above party. And that excites me and is kind of where I spend 3 of my 5 days allocated to working every week at the moment. So I feel like I'd be doing them a disservice if I didn't mention that.
Yeah, well, and I want to get on to what's next for you and what's next for the podcast. But one thing I want to just quickly check in on you is when you set up Government versus the Robots, I presume it was a sort of deliberate decision to be sort of international or sort of global in your perspective in terms of bringing voices in. Why did you choose to do that rather than a sort of a UK specific?
I mean, it's partly pragmatism in terms of knowing that I could speak to interesting people from elsewhere in the world, and having worked in development for the last 10 years, it's quite unusual for me in that, like, I think, but until I was 21, I hadn't left Europe and I'd only really been to France. And then suddenly I went to work in international development and did loads of travel and just kind of like, wow, there's a whole world out there. And that global perspective is really important. And I think that's something that most people that listen to this podcast instinctively get. But for me, it's kind of dearly held because it's a more recent discovery in some respects. But also, like, more seriously, there's a lot of thinking about Britain at the moment because of Brexit and so on. And there's a really important truth that I don't think is present in our national conversation that much at the moment, which is that, like, we are not the country we used to be.
Hmm.
And in some senses, that's obvious given the current state of play. But, like, you know, we're not in the ascendancy. We don't have access to a load of free resource. We have some real economic challenges because of our reliance on the financial sector. Our national debt has doubled under a government which, like, for some mad reason, still seems to maintain a reputation for economic competence. How Britain exists in the 21st century, what type of economy does it have, where are its comparative advantages, all of that, like, feels absent and yet so relevant when people are losing their jobs. The deindustrialised north is still kind of like, hasn't got a renewed, it's got a sense of identity, but doesn't have a, I don't think it's got a, the northern powerhouse doesn't seem to add up to a plan for what to do in terms of economic renewal in the north of the UK. And I mention that because that means you have to look to the rest of the world and understand the rest of the world and think about your place in it and think about where you can best serve other economies. Because if no man is an island, no country, even an island, is an island, really. Mm-hmm. And so I think having an international perspective is really important from that point of view if you want to understand where Britain is. And I think when I think about international development and public attitudes toward aid and development and that sort of stuff, which is a bit more kind of what has been work for me for the last 10 years, the gap between Britain and the rest of the world is shrinking in a lot of respects in terms of, like, well-being and income and kind of the all the measures that economists would tend to use. And so it's important to learn from and cooperate with others and understand what's happening in their environment. So there's that basic point. The other one is that, like, what states are doing matters, and you can't, you know, you can't only look at your own state. I really enjoyed the recent interview on Lies Travel Fast with Amal Khan, where he was talking about how states try to influence the information environment in other states, and I think you have to have a global perspective to be able to understand that. And, you know, you mentioned in the episode that we did the use of WhatsApp in Brazil, and, you know, I've mentioned it today in India. There's a lot of stuff happening that, like, because of globalization and because of the spread of technology, stuff that happens in an election in the Philippines this year will happen in our election next year. If you're interested in getting ahead of the curve and trying to change the world for the better, you need to know what's coming. And it's coming. If you want to know what's coming, wherever there's an election right now, look what's happening on social media and you will see. So is that also, I get frustrated. I think it's important for people to understand, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, that often things, it gets used as a test bed for stuff. Now, that can be a good thing. Like, you know, the drone deliveries in Rwanda, a famous example of how they fly blood to people in medical emergencies. And because it's a really deregulated environment, it's actually much easier. There's a whole episode on drones called Flying Pizza Deliveries, which is worth listening to if you're interested in such things. But equally, like Cambridge Analytica in Kenya and the role that they played in the Kenyan elections, which is murky and not widely understood, but they were there. And now the Kenyan government is bringing forward some of the most oppressive knee-jerk regulation requiring people to give over, residents to give over biometric data, and kind of, you know, as they look east and particularly towards the way that China kind of controls its society, you know, I think that's really worrying. And the ability of governments to control their societies in new ways, which 10 years ago I felt was a kind of like unnecessary thing to be concerned about, in the current political environment feels much more concerning. And then lastly, One of the things we've never really discussed on the podcast, but I think is potentially really interesting, particularly for people who work internationally, is I don't think we'll be that far from language not being that much of an issue. Like, Google Translate is pretty good. I don't know if when you're on holiday, if you ever hover your phone over a menu to work out what you're going to order. No, that's good. But I don't think it'll be that long so we can get like real-time translation online and potentially in person. What that does for the ability of transnational political movements is amazing. Because if you think about the language barrier is such a massive barrier. I, as a comms person, feel really lucky to have a grasp of English and use it well, but I'm awful at almost every other language, and I'm a completely different person. Like, I'm kind of not a person almost. And there's so many people in the world that you can have interesting conversations with that you can't, and those barriers are going to come down. And I would predict, on the basis of no evidence and just kind of that will actually render challenges to nation states. It will completely change the parameters in which politics is conducted. But then right now, the people best equipped to make use of like reduced language barriers is probably the far right across Europe. But that won't necessarily remain the case. And so I think, you know, we shouldn't see other countries, and particularly other countries that aren't our near neighbours, as always being irrelevant to our future political ambitions for the world around us.
So what's next for you and for the podcast?
So podcast, this is the last episode of series two. Oh. How we'll be back and when we'll be back. Right now, I don't know. Like, we did series one and had a break at a similar time. And then I saw lots of interesting stuff happening and couldn't resist kind of reaching out for interviews and so on. When I started Government vs. the Robots, I really hoped that there'd be a kind of community around it. And I feel really lucky to have built a community around it in terms of people who've been on the show. And there's people who engage regularly on social, to whom all of them, thanks for doing so. But because I'm in a position at the moment where I do still have that spare time that I've carved out in my working life, I want to kind of get more practical and hands-on in trying to tackle some of this stuff. And so I'm going to be doing some thinking about how do I do that, whether that's writing over the coming months and maybe putting out a few think pieces, whether it's trying to convene conversations, I don't know. But I guess my plea at this point is, if you're a regular Government versus Robots listener and you either want to get in touch to have a chat and chew the fat and see if there's interesting stuff that you're working on, now is the time to do it. If you've always thought there's something we should cover and we haven't covered it and there's someone we should have on, now is the time to let us know. And equally, if you've enjoyed it and you want to say thanks, please do another series. Now's also the time to let us know as well. And also, I think, I guess it'd be interesting to know which episodes people enjoy most, because I would say we've kind of had three types of episode. There's kind of the, here's a technology, what's happening with it. Then there's a kind of like disinformation, fake news, communications environment conversations. And then there's the more institutional, what's government like, how do we do public services type conversations. Which of those are most interesting to people would be good to know. And lastly, you know, if you've ever wanted to host, or there's an issue that you or your organization thinks is really important and we should do a deep dive into it, again, get in touch. And I know we have the Twitter handle, which is at @govt_vs_robots, but please get in touch with me directly. My email address is jonathanctanner@gmail.com. That's jonathanctanner@gmail.com. And hopefully we'll hear from some people and we'll go somewhere. So I'm definitely going nowhere. The podcast's going on a break. Something will be back in some shape or form in the not too distant future.
Very exciting. Yeah. And I guess without giving too much of your newly acquired and quite extensive skills in the art of making this happen, and I have to say it's not easy sitting on this side.
You've done a great job.
It's a strange experience. But what are your, I guess, sort of top tips if people want to try and create content like this?
It's kind of hard not to reduce it. I always try. I mean, as people who listen to it, I always try and end on a positive note. So, I mean, I guess just do it. A story I sometimes tell about Government versus the Robots, when I first started thinking about making it, I wanted to have an academic perspective and a practitioner perspective, and I was going to have two guests on each episode. And so, around driverless cars, Isabel was the second guest, and there was somebody who won't be named, but who came in and gave a really academic perspective on driverless cars. And that was really useful for informing me. The interview was like really quite dry and probably wouldn't have made for fantastic listening. And I was down here in the studio after I'd finished. I was like, okay, that was a reasonable start. Like, maybe I need to cut it quite a lot. So I looked over at the computer and I realised I hadn't recorded any of the interview.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, oh, my God, I'm a total idiot. Why am I even trying to do this? Like, I'm just not equipped for this sort of stuff at all. And then I realised, like, with a bit of help from somebody else, I asked him if he'd come back and re-record. He said no. And then I was like, I don't need that. I only need one person per episode. They just need to be interesting. And so I guess my number one tip is make it as simple as you can. And then when you think you've made it as simple as you can probably make it simpler again. But also, like, kind of get on with it. You know, this was born for me out of wanting to sort of partly want to prove something to myself, if I'm honest. And just being like, okay, I'm going to do this, see where it goes, see what happens. Unless you try, you'll never know. I guess I'd made podcasts for Tony Blair Institute in like Sierra Leone and Liberia, and we made one for ODI, and I interviewed some interesting people, so I knew I'd enjoy it. But it's carving out the time in my work life and going, right, I'm going to do this, was daunting, but it's been an absolutely fantastic experience so far. So, you know, in terms of how do you make it, there is no better answer than make time and try.
Well, I'm very glad that you did. I think I've greatly enjoyed getting to sit with you and incredibly interesting people in my ears as I'm on the bus or doing whatever, and I've learned a lot, and it has definitely informed my work. So thank you both for sitting today to share your reflections, but also for all of the time and energy that goes into making this great contribution to society.
Cool. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That's all from Government versus the Robots for the summer. Huge thanks, as ever, to Sky Redman for her help with the editing and production of this podcast. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at @GOVT_VS_robots. In the meantime, enjoy the holidays, and we'll be back at some point in the future.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.